atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Northern Kentucky University political scientist Michael Baranowski. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson, as well as welcoming back University of Northern Iowa political scientist, Justin Holmes. I'm glad to have both of you back. Jay, you're going to have to do sort of Fezzik was the giant in Princess Bride, right? Who could fight off many men. And so Jay will be fighting off two center left folks. I think he's more than up to the task, and we are looking forward to laying into him and seeing what he can do. We have a lot to talk about this week. We're going to get into, we'll talk a little bit about remembrance of Joe Lieberman, the abortion pill up oral argument before the Supreme Court this last week, the recommendation that John Eastman be disbarred, NBC hiring and then quickly letting go of Ronna McDaniel, the True Social IPO. There is a ton of stuff, and we should just get right to it. So we'll start with sort of a remembrance, I guess. Joe Lieberman, he died this week at the age of 82. He was a centrist Democrat turned independent, a four-term U.S. senator from Connecticut, served from 1989 through 2013, as well as Al Gore's running mate in the 2000 presidential election. He actually ran for president himself in 2004, but basically gained no traction at all with Democratic primary voters, ended up suspending his campaign pretty early on. And then a couple of years later, he was running for his fourth term to represent Connecticut in the Senate. He actually lost the Democratic primary to a guy named Ned Lamont. And you might say, who? Exactly the right response, because Lieberman ended up running as an independent and winning pretty convincingly. And when he won, he said this was a declaration of independence from the politics of partisanship. Little did he know. Anyway, and in 2008, John McCain, who was a GOP nominee, actually seriously considered Lieberman as a running mate before making what in hindsight was, at least to me, the much poorer choice of Sarah Palin. And Lieberman actually ended up endorsing McCain. It put him on the outs with Democrats in the Senate for a little while there. Now, more recently, in 2017, he was actually interviewed by then-President Donald Trump as a possible FBI director, but Lieberman ended up withdrawing his name from consideration. He also is a co-chair of No Labels, a group that was founded to support political centrism, bipartisan cooperation, that sort of thing. And he was more than just a name on the promotional material. He was actually one of the key participants in No Labels' very recent efforts to recruit a presidential ticket for the 2024 election. And he made it clear that he did not want No Labels to be a spoiler. Specifically, he did not want it to be a spoiler that would end up helping Donald Trump win. A few weeks ago, in fact, he told reporters about Trump, "To me personally, stopping him from being reelected is a goal even greater than restoring bipartisanship to Washington." And so he was really pushing for No Labels to have someone right of center lead the group's ticket to make it more likely that if No Labels is going to draw from anyone, it would be more from Trump than from potential Biden voters. And so we're going to get a lot more into No Labels and third party candidates later on, either in this show or in the midweek show. But for now, Jay, I want to start with you. What did you think of Joe Lieberman? I guess both, you know, who he was, and maybe even more than that, what he maybe represented.
Yeah, he will certainly be missed. He was a smart gentleman, sort of what you would expect of, you know, the Senate sort of used to be called the world's greatest, you know, deliberative body. He would fit well in there. My sense is he was always more of a problem solver than a grandstander. And yeah, things have changed and for the worse, but he certainly did what he could during that time. You had asked like a couple weeks ago, Mike, about or there was a listener question of what Democratic senator would I like to have a beer with? And I had said, not a senator, but House Member Tip O'Neill. But I should have thought of Joe Lieberman, because he would have been one of those people who really understood government, really understood politics, and also saw politics as an end to having a better country rather than just a means to vanquishing your ideological foes.
Justin, do you see a lot of Joe Liebermans in the Senate on either side anymore these days?
No, I think he's kind of the last of a type, you know, and I don't know how well that would play at this point in kind of this hyper-polarized world. You know, I agree with Jay. I think he was, you know, kind of a consummate hard worker, get things done, negotiator, bridge the divide kind of person. And, you know, I mean, there's maybe two people in the Senate left, both of whom are leaving, that, you know, maybe fill that role, but I don't think fill it anywhere near as well. I think, you know, in particular on the sort of not grandstanding and actually getting things done thing. So, you know, I think his existence did speak to a desire, at least in some places, for, you know, kind of a different kind of politics. I mean, it's interesting to see him in Connecticut running as an independent. Doesn't work very often. And, you know, basically pulling support from both, you know, Democrats and some Republicans. Clearly has some issues with the Democratic base, you know, not being able to win that primary, you know, for his Senate seat. But, you know, I think ultimately, you know, it's that kind of compromiser that you just don't see a whole lot anymore.
Yeah, definitely. That's certainly my view as well. And so I think we can all agree that policy aside, that the Senate would be a better place if there were more people who had sort of the basic approach to the job of being a senator that Joe Lieberman seemed to have. And so that will be missed.
Sure.
All right. Well, let's move on to our next story. And Jay, this is one actually that I'm going to let you take the lead on and kind of get people up to speed. Big news in the Supreme Court, at least an important oral argument this last week.
Yeah. So an interesting oral argument, Mike. An FDA versus Alliance Hippocratic Medicine, Supreme Court heard oral argument on Tuesday. This is the case regarding the FDA approval of mifepristone.
It's hard for me too. I know.
you can tell everyone at the court like practiced over and over saying it.
Yeah.
But the issue on this mifepristone is an abortifacient pill that can be mail ordered. And the FDA approved it for mail order use in 2016. Now, recently, a group of doctors challenged the FDA approval on a number of grounds. One, that it was flawed under the original approval, was flawed under the APA, and also alleging conscience issues that this approval essentially forced them to participate in abortions, which violated their conscience rights and federal statutes protecting it. The justices seemed skeptical across the board of these particular plaintiffs' challenge. Now, to be clear also, I mean, as always, the press tends to build these things up as, oh, this is a case about abortion, but really it was much more a case about standing in administrative law, with the justices being particularly skeptical of whether these particular doctors had standing based on the fact that none of them prescribed mifepristone, none of them used it, none of them could trace any specific harm that they suffered. The argument being, well, they always had the conscience clause, they wouldn't have to treat, they wouldn't have to perform an abortion that had been induced by mifepristone. So that seemed to be the issue. But the conservative justices brought up an interesting point as well, administrative law, the point of that if these doctors don't have standing to pursue this, is there anyone who ever could? And the government, in a real sort of bout of candidness, said, well, no. And that seemed to disconcert some conservative justices as well as me. But that's more or less how the argument went. And I'm just going to throw one, I shouldn't do this in just the introduction piece, but really people should go listen to Supreme Court oral arguments because they're a ton of fun and they're really smart, and you will come away smarter and I think feeling better about your country and justice system generally. But with that, then I would pitch to Justin.
Yeah, you know, I agree that the standing issue is where the court seemed to be, and it also really seemed to me to be sort of at the heart of this. You know, clearly you need somebody that's been, you know, harmed in some way by this. And it was really not at all clear that these folks suffer any specific harm, you know, other than they don't like that you can get mifepristone. Right. I hope I'm saying that right as well. But, you know, that doesn't seem to be sort of grounds for standing. You know, if you open up that can of worms, you know, basically anybody can sue over anything, you know, that oh, I'm just angry about this. And yeah. You know, that's not ideal. You know, it was interesting to hear so many of even the conservative justices go in on that standing argument. There have been a few cases lately where I've been a little suspicious of kind of granting standing in the first place. And so, you know, to see three of them, it looked like, you know, kind of wanting to punt on this, you know, on standing grounds. Maybe that's not a punt, but that, you know, just as opposed to any other underlying legal questions. I thought that was probably the big
punt, headline. In the way of like not reaching the merits, but yeah, that's still there's still a plainly meritorious procedural question that has to get answered first.
Right. So clearly. So, you know, I think the other issue is, you know, sort of bigger than abortion. I think you're right, absolutely, that, you know, this is pitched as an abortion case, but it is also bigger than that, which I think, frankly, maybe works against the plaintiffs. You know, as I'm looking at this, my thought is, you know, if they were to side with the plaintiffs, both on standing and on the merits of the case, you know, what does this do to the FDA in general at that point? You know, does that let anybody with, you know, sort of any sort of concern about any medication, you know, jump in and, you know, go after that? And that feels like a very kind of thing that John Roberts in particular would want to avoid, you know, just sort of that maximalist, you know, impact that might be there. To me, in the end, this whole thing feels more like sort of less of a legal question and more sort of a technical and political one. You know, on that question of, you know, standing and who can sue, you know, that nobody, there's a part of me that thinks, well, maybe that's kind of right. I mean, I'm not sure that this is something that necessarily the courts are the right venue for in dealing with.
On that issue, I want to kind of pull back just a little bit, because this wouldn't have gotten to the Supreme Court if the district court and the Fifth Circuit hadn't concluded that, in fact, the plaintiffs did have standing. And what the Fifth Circuit said was that essentially that this doctor's group did, in fact, have standing because they were seeking what's called prospective relief. And they, under precedence of the court, then what they have to do was establish that some sort of threatened injury is a certain, what they call certainly impending, or that there's a substantial risk that it will occur. And so the question that you probably are asking people is, well, what is that? And well, what they were arguing is that, well, the potential injury is that even though there's this conscience clause that allows us them not to have to use mifepristone, that they might have to treat people who are suffering from complications of using mifepristone. And at least for a majority on Supreme Court, that was sort of like, there needs to be a much closer nexus here. You can't just say, well, it's conceivably possible that at some point someone. And so I think that's where the district judge and the Fifth Circuit were like, well, okay, good enough. And the Supreme Court is saying, I don't think so much.
Yeah. So we can't say they're saying, I don't think so just yet, but we can certainly say they seem skeptical based on their questions. And I think that's a good point. The government argued and the Supreme Court seemed to pick up on the idea that the remoteness of the potential injury here, that there were a number of things that all had to happen, right, in order for one of these doctors to have a potential foregoing injury. And that it did seem, as one justice sort of said, kind of like, you know, lightning striking, right? It's sort of a really unusual set of circumstances that would somehow, you know, it had to do with, you know, well, if you're the only person who happens to be on duty that night and you're in this, you know, certain place where someone comes in and has the injury. And it, I mean, it was like a whole lot of what ifs. And you are one of the, you know, group of seven or so plaintiffs here who, you know, in the entire country who happens to be on staff. And it seems pretty far flung. That said, I do think there were some, there's an interesting question, and the court seemed to be pushing. And a lot of times this is what the court does. And this is why the court takes these cases, is because maybe they'll say, no, there's no standing here, but this is a good vehicle for us to explain, or better explain, when there is standing. So the justices kind of probe both sides as to, okay, tell us when this would be a substantial risk that you would suffer the injury, or if the other side, a substantial risk that in an injury would be suffered. So I think it's interesting there. And again, my reading of the, you know, from the questions, it sounds like the court is not inclined to say they're standing, but you might get an interesting decision on when there is, why there isn't, and when there might be.
And I think, guys, there's, speaking of interesting questions, there was one interesting question that was raised by Justices Thomas and Alito, which they would be the ones at this point. They're saying, hey, guys, what about the Comstock Act? And that's not something we tend to talk about a lot. Let me kind of explain. The Comstock Act was passed way back in 1873. And it bans all kinds of stuff. This was like a serious morals kind of thing. One of the things it bans is, and I quote, every article or thing designed, adapted, or intended for producing abortion or for any indecent or immoral use, and every article, instrument, substance, drug, medicine, or thing which is advertised or described in a manner calculated to lead another to use or apply it for producing abortion or for any indecent or immoral purpose. And what Justice Thomas...
Stuff.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And what Justices Thomas Alito were wondering is like, hey, there's this law. It's on the books. Is this something you considered? Because it sure seems like this is using the mails to send things that are intended to abort a pregnancy. So what do you have to say about that? It's not an unreasonable question. Jay, what do you think on that?
No, I think it's not an unreasonable question. And I think it's foreshadowing what the next case is going to be, right, which is the use of the mails and the Commerce Clause, as opposed to this case, which was about FDA approval. And the answers that were given by sort of both sides really was, look, we acknowledge the FDA's decision is not based on anything, you know, based on the legal, moral, et cetera. But rather is just purely medical safety and efficacy. Yeah. So I think everybody sort of dodged the question, but I think they're raising it because that will likely be an issue in another case sometime in the future.
I
don't think that the Comstock Act, I think there may be, it would be probably partially struck down. I think you could still say that board efficiency, that part is clear, although I don't know. I mean,
well, lower courts
challenge. I don't know.
Yeah, lower courts, I believe, in some cases have said that it only applies to drugs used for abortion that are being sent without prescription or
without
in some
approval.
Illegal manner. But to me, that's not the plain reading of the act, and so it seems. An important point. Also, I'll point out that the Comstock Act used to include bans on anything related to preventing contraception, and that actually was amended in 1971 to remove that. And so it seems to me, right, if you're going to go by the law means what it says, well, the path here is to do another amendment then to allow for this. But, and this is not the policy outcome I like, but it seems to me, according to a law that is on the books, it pretty clearly disallows sending a mifepristone or anything else through the mails. And I don't like that. I think Congress should change that. But if I were on the court, I would look at that and say, well, I don't know what you want me to do, guys. It's illegal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Justin?
Oh, you know, I think just the kind of the general theme of this, you know, I have a suspicion that, you know, probably this gets struck down on standing, but that the decision ultimately reads as a roadmap, you know, more or less to how to do this right the next time, you know, from the conservative standpoint. And, you know, I think that Comstock Act part, you know, maybe they want to downplay it now, but that may come up as a big thing, you know, later on. And, you know, I agree with you, Mike. I, you know, it's not the outcome that I want, you know, either, but with that law in the books, it's kind of, you know, there's some merit to that claim, I suppose, you know, from a legal standpoint.
Yeah. You know, another aspect of this should point out is that if the court rules the way it seems like most people think it's going to rule on that standing issue, that there isn't standing, well, then what would happen essentially is that the FDA's expansions of access to mifepristone that were done in 2016 and 2021 would still stand. And that's an important thing, because post Dobbs, when a lot of states had either new laws or laws that triggered into effect that limited the ability for women to obtain an abortion, abortion pills like mifepristone have become an important way for women to gain access to that sort of thing. I think I saw something like 60% of abortions are performed through this drug means. And so that's why it's a big deal. And that's why both sides are so focused on this sort of thing. And it's certainly not going away in any sense. Okay, well, let's move on. And Jay, this is another story that I was hoping you could get everyone up to speed on, a potential disbarment of an attorney who was fairly prominently involved in Donald Trump's 2020 rigged election, whatever arguments.
Yeah, Mike. So earlier this week, Judge Yvette Roland, the California Disciplinary Court, recommended that ex-Trump lawyer John Eastman be disbarred in a, it's something like a, the opinion goes on for like 100, almost 180, at least 120 pages. I think it's maybe 120 some pages, detailing that Eastman should be disbarred for, among other things, making false representations to the courts, essentially assisting in a crime or attempted crimes, and violating the Constitution. Now, California's barcode is different than a lot of other states, and it seems fairly broad. So this is sort of the, Roland wrote that Eastman failed to uphold his primary duty of honesty and breached his ethical obligations by presenting falsehoods to bolster his legal arguments. In sum, Eastman exhibited gross negligence by making false statements about the 2020 election without conducting any meaningful investigation or verification of the information he was relying on. Now, as we'll discuss, I have some pretty significant criticisms of what the judge did here, but I'll go to your thoughts first.
Well, you know, the other thing, it seemed to me, she said something about how, well, you know, if he'd only been a little bit contrite, right? And then part of her decision, that was a long decision, right? That he was unwilling to admit to any sort of ethical lapses. And as such, that was part of her reason why it's like, well, this guy seems to think he didn't do anything wrong. And so this is even more reason to disbar him. I guess I understand your concerns on this, because his argument, Eastman's argument, is essentially, well, I was zealously representing my client's interests. And that's obviously what you, if he didn't do that, that would be a problem for an ethical problem. But there's also a line between doing that and violating ethical standards, or even more than that, advocating illegal activity. And so it seems to me that the question here is, well, did John Eastman know, or should he have reasonably known, that what he was advocating for was in fact illegal? And the judge's conclusion is that he can say what he wants, but any reasonable person in his position, any attorney, would have to have known, which is why Mike Pence rejected his argument and so many other. And this, Jay, reminds me of what we were talking about with Donald Trump's culpability. You can't just say, well, I just cherry picked all the evidence on one side. I ignore all the evidence on the other side. And so therefore, my delusional state of mind makes me non-culpable. And that seems to be what the judge concluded here. So that's sort of my take on it. Justin?
My take is really pretty close to yours. You know, I think this is something that you have to take very seriously, because, you know, we don't want to put a chill on people providing, you know, zealous representation. But I do think he crossed a number of lines here. You know, in his defense, much like, you know, your point, struck me as not great. You know, this idea that, well, you know, I believed in the information that I had, you know, et cetera. You know, we can sort of dispute the quality of that information and my, you know, what I've seen of that, kind of the evidence of fraud that they were presenting was not particularly strong, to put it mildly. But, you know, it's one thing to have not particularly strong data. It's another thing to sort of understand why it's not. And you know, if he believes what he believes, I mean, I suppose that's a defense of sorts. I don't know if it's a great defense, you know, but the other part of this to me is that, you know, it's one thing to sort of argue that stuff in court. And you know, ultimately that's for kind of a judge and jury to sort out whether, you know, this is convincing evidence or not. But this is really the wrong venue for that. You know, all of this fraud stuff had been presented in court before and really hadn't gone anywhere. And, you know, to move over to basically plotting to, you know, ignore the election and stay in office, that seems like a whole other thing. I mean, that's almost, you know, sort of it is an extra legal, you know, sort of activity. And that feels like the kind of thing that really shouldn't be covered if we're out here, you know, outside of the courtroom and, you know, essentially scheming to stay in power. You know, that seems pretty unreasonable. And frankly, the rejection of that by an awful lot of other lawyers and, you know, Mike Pence, et cetera, I think really kind of kicks the legs out of, you know, the defense that he tried to present.
Jay,
so I'm going to take the very diametrically opposed view here.
Yeah, do that.
And this is troubling to me on so many grounds. And I'll also note, just from a practitioner standpoint, right, that if this is the standard for disbarment, I can name like half a dozen people who have done this in the last week who should be disbarred. Right, attorneys have a right to believe their clients. And that's, you know, pretty standard. The attorneys have a right to advise their clients and even give their clients bad advice. Attorneys have a right to get expert reports and rely on expert reports, even though those expert reports might not be the greatest. The way you fix those problems isn't by having the attorney for the side presenting the case sort of pre-screen the entire case. And then go in and say, oh, look, judge, my expert really, really sucks. Rather, it's the adversarial process of letting the other side come up and say, judge, his expert really sucks, which is something that happens every day, all the time in courts. It's going forward and saying, well, this case stands for this proposition when, you know, plainly it's a real, real stretch to say so. And to me, this remedy, the extreme sanction of disbarment, is really beyond the pale. And here's the other thing. Going back again, this is from a practitioner standpoint. Typically, the penalty, right, of making a frivolous argument in court or presenting something that turns out to be a waste of the court's time, typically any penalty when it's imposed at all is, all right, the other side gets attorney's fees up to this amount, or you get sanctioned X amount because you wasted the court's time on this argument that shouldn't have been brought. It's not disbarment. That's so far beyond the other thing is if you read the opinion and I did, it is much more about John Eastman doesn't make an appearance until about page 25 or so. It's all about Trump. And there's also this sort of ex post facto type looking back of, well, they couldn't prove their case or they lost. But, you know, you don't, when you file the suit, you don't have all the facts. You don't know that you're going to win. You don't know what facts you're going to have. Now, you need to have a reasonable basis to think you've got a claim and to think you're going to have those facts. But there's one piece where the judge says, well, obviously he knew this was frivolous because there's emails between him and other counsel where he says, look, we've got the sort of statistical stuff, the stuff from the experts saying, you know, that they think that there had to have been fraud because of the statistics on this. And Eastman says, you know, I'd really feel a lot better if we had hard evidence of this. And, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. I mean, you see that in so many cases, right? Especially when you're accusing someone of fraud. Very rarely do you have the hard evidence of fraud right in front of you when you begin the case. That's why you have discovery. And in this case, you've got things moving very quickly. Everything's expedited. You're not getting all this discovery stuff in. You know, it's not the normal course of trial. And I have a real problem with that, saying that, look, because, you know, you eventually couldn't support your case, therefore you should be disbarred.
I agree with a lot of that fundamentally, but it seems to me there's an important distinction to be drawn, at least to me. Maybe I'm wrong, and you guys will tell me if I am, but especially Jay, but it seems to me it's one thing. Yeah, it's one thing to make that argument in a courtroom setting where the state is accusing your client of something, or someone is, and your client is defending themselves. But this is an instance where Donald Trump either went to John Eastman or between John Eastman and Trump and said, well, listen, I think I want to stay in office. And Eastman says, well, here's a thing you can try. And let's put together a slate of these alternate electors. That's very different than defending. Just like if John Eastman had said, well, listen, here's something you can do. You can go ahead and have these 50 electors killed. And that will have a chilling effect on the rest of them. And then they'll vote for you. Now, you would, if he did that, you would say, well, no, you can't do that. Disbarment, that seems reasonable.
I would agree. Recommending killing electors would be.
But my point is.
I'm not even sure that gets you disbarred.
But my point.
That's bad legal advice, but I don't know.
But you see my point.
It's a malpractice. A malpractice claim.
But my point is that attorneys cannot actively recommend illegal activities that they know to be illegal as part of a defense.
Correct.
And so, so I hear what you're saying, but I also think that if we conclude, and reasonable people I think can differ on this, if we conclude that John Eastman knew that this action, this that he suggested, was outside of the law, and he recommended, not just recommended it to his client, but actually advocated for it in a broader sense. Therefore, he went so far outside his ethical and even legal boundaries that disbarment would be reasonable. And if we accept that, right, that's a reasonable, logical conclusion, even you having said the things you said, Jay, right?
Well, again, I would start to draw the line of, okay, did he actually recommend a crime? Or is that decision or the determination that that's a crime being imposed ex post facto?
I see what you're saying. Okay, gotcha.
That's Latin for after the fact.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There seems to be sort of the circularity of, well, we determined that that was not a valid legal theory. Therefore, you raised a non-valid legal theory. The same could be said, right? If it's 1952. And you're suing the Topeka Board of Education, saying, listen, I think black children should be able to go to school with white children. The state could clearly say, listen, the law on this is absolutely clear. Have you read Plessy versus Ferguson? Come on. There is no debate, no discussion on this question. And you're here coming in making this case to the court that you think the law ought to be different, or you're saying that somehow you think the Constitution supersedes what the court said in Plessy. Get out of here. You ought to be disbarred for raising this frivolous crap, right? if it's 1972 and you're going to the Supreme Court saying, listen, I think I should have a right to abortion. And the court would say, come on, when in the history of the world have we ever recognized a right to abortion? But now you're here telling us you have a 14th Amendment right emanating from a penumbra in the 9th and 10th and all because it's kind of sort of in there, substantive due process. Get out of here. Right. I mean, that's the concern is look, Eastman made some terrible arguments. It was a really dumb argument to say, well, the vice president can do this. But there is a statute. It's not like he just said, you know, made this up entirely. And I think it was, again, terrible legal advice. But the remedy for bad legal advice is a malpractice suit or it's fees to the other side. It's not disbarment. But the star, you know, the asterisk is, well, unless it has to do with Trump. And this goes a little bit to kind of what I was talking about last week about the, you know, Joe Biden and institutions, that there is this concern of look, in this case, Trump said, hey, what are my options? And Eastman says, well, look, we got this crazy old statute from 1877 or whatever it is. Nobody's ever, you know, tried this before. This is plainly a long shot. This is really aggressive, but that's what I got. And again, look, it's bad legal advice. But I don't think it's the disbarrable kind of legal advice, especially reading through the court's analysis of this. And that's what even troubled me more was a lot of this. Well, he based this on reports of experts that, you know, proved to be then discredited. OK, fair enough. But again, that's something that happens every day in court. If someone comes in, one side comes in with an expert saying, listen, my client is permanently and totally disabled for the rest of his life and is owed millions and millions of dollars. And the other side comes in and says, look, we've done an independent medical evaluation and really he's fine. That's, you know, that's how courts are supposed to work. And judges and juries make those determinations and somebody wins and somebody loses. But just because you lose doesn't mean then, you are subsequently disbarred. That's sort of my concern. I was thinking about this of, you know, like the boy who cried wolf, you know, the idea of being, if you cry wolf too often, people stop listening to you. This is sort of the converse of it of, look, if the state says we are therefore going to outlaw crying wolf, or if you do cry wolf, and there's no wolf, there's some significant penalties. That's not a good result either, because sometimes there are wolves.
Justin, what do you think? Has Jay convinced you on this, or what's your take?
He raises a lot of good points, you know, and certainly I'm not a practitioner of the law, although I suppose genetically I have a legal connection. But I think side with Mike, where I mean this feels like it goes beyond legal advice. You know, at some point and really lapses over into, you know, something altogether more nefarious. You know, I think, you know, I would agree that, you know, kind of relying on shoddy experts, he probably doesn't have the wherewithal to really evaluate the expertise, but
especially in a short evolving time frame, right? This is not something we're allowed. The study came out 5 years ago and now it's been looked at. This is
absolutely. And I think it's easy. You know, I don't think a lot of lawyers have, you know, training in reading statistics, you know, particularly. And so it's pretty easy to say, OK, that's got numbers on it. And you know, we'll go from there. As somebody that knows statistics and not the law, you know, I have a very different feeling about what was presented, but I wouldn't hold them to that standard. I think the concern is more, I mean, once you're sort of, you know, out of the courtroom, I mean, this feels a whole lot more like, you know, conspiring to, you know, break the law to me rather than sort of arguing, you know, zealously in a court. And so I'm inclined, you know, whether, you know, disbarment is a step too far, I'm inclined to think there should be some sanction and a pretty serious sanction for what happened here.
Yeah. You know, the more I'm really of two minds, at least on this, because I do think it's important to allow attorneys to make all kinds of arguments, even if they're bad arguments, even if they're, like you said, Hail Marys. And there is that line, of course, where an attorney would recommend breaking the law, something they absolutely knew would be in violation of the law. And I, your analogy that you made back toward, you know, the 50s and the 70s with the reproductive rights and integration of schools, those have clearly be attorneys saying, recommending that the law, well, saying that the law is wrong. That there's a distinction.
Right. And you're allowed to argue, yes, specifically for a, what's called a good faith extension of the law. Yeah.
And so I feel like there is a distinction between that sort of thing that you're talking about and the sort of thing that I was, that my extreme example, right, of saying, well, hey, just kill a few of them and the rest of them will fall on the line. That would not be an okay argument, right? That would. And so then my question to myself is, well, where does Eastman's conduct fall? Does it fall more into the sense of what you were talking about with the segregation of schools and reproductive rights, or more along the let's kill some electors thing? And honestly, I feel like if I'm not sure on that, then I have to give the benefit of the doubt to the free speech, the representation. And that means that in the end, I feel I have to conclude that even though I think what Eastman did was ethically sketchy as hell, that he shouldn't be disbarred for it. And so in the end, the kind of, I think the process of thinking about this and talking this out and hearing some of your examples has made me think that, you know, yeah, and there's also, there's something that Eastman's attorney raised that I don't know how important it is, but it certainly plays a role. He said, listen, you're basically saying that if you disbar him, you are depriving him of his livelihood to defend himself against these charges in Georgia. He's got the eight counts there. And so that isn't directly relevant to the legal aspect of this, but that element that you talked about, well, are they out to get pro-Trump sort of people? It certainly plays into that. And so I won't go so far as to say I have sympathy for John Eastman, but I got to say, I, in the end, I don't agree with the judge's decision here. So I'm going with you on
came
this
around.
One. Yeah.
You know, well, let me, again, I shouldn't spike the ball here, but again, the issue is when, and I mentioned the Brown versus the Board, keep in mind, if you remember, one of the key pieces of evidence in Brown versus the Board were these psychological studies that, you know, were really not had any, you know, great basis, scientific basis, right? If the kids playing with dolls, and which dolls would they rather play with, and all this sort of thing. That's, you know, that I am very unlikely that would that stand up to today's standard evidentiary standards for expert evidence or even make it into the record. But yet, you know, we do this. And again, the sanction for raising a really dumb legal theory is that you lose. And that's okay, because, you know, part of the one of the function the court serves is to say, yeah, that's really stupid. You know, no, we don't mean that. And look, he's raising a question. He's arguing that for a good faith extension of the law of reading of the Electoral Count Act, that would allow. And again, and this comes out in the opinion, actually. You know, what he's arguing for is Mike Pence to say, I'm not going to certify this yet. There needs to be a pause for the states to look at this. Again, I think that's incorrect. But I don't think it's,
His advice to Trump wasn't, well, just to hell with the law. Let's just stage a coup.
Yeah.
Which that would be.
Yeah. Now, again, if his advice was, we ought to get a mob and storm the Capitol.
Yeah.
Well, that's something different.
And in fact, that was the one charge, right, of those 11 things where the judge says, well, no, he wasn't part of the incitement. I believe that was the one of the 11 charges that she found
So that's my concern is the one, this chilling effect that it would have. And look, Mike, and again, the stakes aren't as high, right? And a lot of stuff, but I can point you to like five or six instances within the last 5 days that I've encountered of people putting stuff in pleadings that are absolutely not true. And again, what's going to happen is it's going to go to the court and we're going to do discovery and somebody's going to say, yeah, I guess that wasn't true. And then, you know, all right, then you lose that point. And there are plenty of times this doesn't necessarily affect this one because it's kind of Eastman coming up with the idea. But clients tell you stuff that turns out not to be true. And, you know, but again, you're entitled, in fact, required. Right now, you can do sort of you need to do a reasonable thing to say, listen, is this a legitimate cause of action? But the courts give a really, really wide strike zone on that for the very reason that look, you know, our issue is to hear disputes. If there is, you know, let's hear it. And they're very sensitive to the idea of raising that conversation.
I would like to think, and you'll maybe disagree with me, I would like to think that part of this decision and the general feeling about what Eastman did is less about Donald Trump and more about concerns about the peaceful transfer of power. And anything that disrupts that goes to sort of the heart of democracy and the democratic process. And when it feels like somebody is doing things that threaten that call that into question, I think that raises hackles, that makes us feel really uncomfortable. And I would like to think that if a Democrat had been in office and that had been the case, that there would be a similar sort of almost immune system reaction by the system. And sometimes that's an overreaction. But I think that it's maybe not just the Trump thing. I'm not saying that's not part of it. Maybe it may not be. I don't know enough about the, you know, judge or history or anything like that. But it's also just like a democracy felt threatened. It felt legitimately threatened, right? When you have literally a mob storming the Capitol. And that's a powerful thing. I think about that now, and I can remember where I was and how I felt and how surreal and horrible it felt. And I think that's a big part of it, not just that it was Donald Trump, but it was like a fundamental threat to the entire system. And that freaks out a lot of people. And I think maybe that's not necessarily such a bad thing. And, you know, it makes me think about how, Jay, you and I talked about, in a sense, in the aftermath of that, almost a good chilling effect, in that when we see all these cases go against the people who push for these weird things, that it's going to make in the future, potentially, it less likely for attorneys to say, oh, sure, I'll advance this crazy argument that will maybe allow somebody to stay in power when they shouldn't. Then they'll think, well, no, because, geez, look what happened to Rudy. Look what happened to Sidney. Look what happened to John. I don't want to be part of that. And so I understand your arguments, but I also that part of my sort of democracy immune system feels like, yeah, that's maybe not such an awful thing in that sense. So yeah, Justin, any thoughts on that?
I think I would tend to agree. I mean, you know, the technical side of you know, the nuance of you know, lawyer ethics is you know, perhaps not my forte, but I do think that, you know, on the one hand, yeah, I mean, chilling legitimate behavior is a concern, but, you know, ultimately we sanction people to serve as a deterrent would be sort of the other, you know, term for that when it's, you know, perhaps considered just. And I do think, you know, some of these things probably ought to be deterred, you know, kind of getting under the hood of democracy with a hammer and trying to sort of upend the system. I don't think that's something that needs to be encouraged. You know, I think if you know, this stops people from doing that sort of thing down the road, you know, I think there's a lot of value in that. You know, I don't want to see a repeat of this, you know, going forward. And, you know, ultimately, I think that's where I come down on this, is that, you know, some things just shouldn't be okay. And this feels like one of them. And so, you know, if it discourages people from following in his footsteps, I don't see that as a bad thing.
Jay?
But one last point, though, is I understand that there's the January 6th and the striking sort of, again, as you say, hit to the immune system, right? That you feel like they're gonna, But I'd go back to the causation piece of it. Eastman's job, you know, he was asked by a client, hey, what are my options? He came up with an option that is not a good one. And his client chose to move forward with that. And it got out of hand, and his client didn't do anything to stop what was happening. But again, does that all rest on Eastman? Is an attorney required to pull his legal punches, so to speak, because of fear of what the client might do? I don't want to give my client this advice, even though, look, there's a legal argument for it, because he might do this and this might happen and that might happen. And I think that's a problem. There's a chilling effect there. Now, if you read the opinion, and there's some wonderful excerpts from, I believe it's Pence's counsel who's writing back to Eastman, who's saying, God, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. It's completely irresponsible. You should be ashamed of yourself. You're causing all kinds of trouble. You know, knock it off. Mike isn't going to cancel the counting. So, I mean, I think that comes down to what the remedy is, right? That, you know, you have an attorney who should exercise judgment in saying, listen, here's this option, but I would advise against it because a lot of bad things could happen and your chances of succeeding are really, really, really slim.
Right. So in a way, it's kind of a trust the system argument, in that if an attorney advances an argument that is that bad, well, then the courts should say, hey, this is a horrible argument, which is exactly what happened with almost all of the arguments that the multitude of Trump attorneys made about various reasons why he, and as we pointed out at the time, it's loss after loss after loss. And your point is, well, that's how it's supposed to work. And you want to let the attorneys have as much leeway as possible. And if they want to make bad arguments and look like fools and lose and be even ostracized by the rest of the legal profession, that's perfectly okay. But it's not okay to say, well, you can't practice law.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's sort of like, in a way, it's sort of like, this is the sort of thing that allows, you know, the Saul Goodmans of the world to exist, right? It's like,
well, it does, right? Yeah. And look, there is, yeah, we could have a great talk on legal ethics stuff someday, but, yeah, very, very rarely do you ever see courts weighing in on, on motions to dismiss sanctioning. Again, frivolous conduct is such a high bar, and so often I'm lamenting that, right? Because I see, you know, the others, I'm like, Jesus, I should file a motion for sanctions against this guy. The court's not going to do anything about it. The court's going to say, yeah, we looked at this. You know what? That's a crappy argument on his side. You win. Congrats. Can I have attorney's fees? No. And that's also always like the first question you get from any client is, well, you know, why don't I get my attorney fees
exactly,
if this argument is so frivolous? Because courts don't want to, and then there's, you know, tremendous debate, not tremendous debate, but there's been debate for decades on, you know, the American rule versus the English rule. In England, the loser pays. And, you know, part of tort reform efforts in the 90s was to try to get that to happen. And it never did. Think about the imposition of attorney's fees is a much smaller sanction than complete disbarment. So,
all right. Well, I think that, go ahead. No, it would be an interesting, I was just trying to think in my head of what Saul Goodman's defense of Donald Trump would have been. A very special episode of Better Call Saul. Anyway, interesting crossover potential there. With that thought planted, unfortunately, in everyone's head, maybe we'll end on that note. But before we do go, if there was anything that we discussed on this episode that you disagreed with, maybe you have a question about, you'd love to hear more for us talk about, just let us know. You can reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. There's also Facebook and X, and we always put those links in the show notes. There's also, as in addition to that, our Discord discussion forum. I am on that, well, way more than I probably should be. But I go back and forth all the time, and that's a lot of fun as well. And so if that's for supporters, if you're not already a supporter, I hope you'll consider becoming one. There's not just that. There's a bunch of other things, ad-free versions of everything we put out, the full midweek episode, not just that preview. Check it out. Go to patreon.com/politicsguys, and we always have the link in the show notes as well. And if you would like to get that full-length midweek episode, but you're not in a position to financially support the show right now, just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com. I can get you set up with that complete access. And whether you're a supporter or not, it really does help. If you can just take a minute right now, if you're still listening, some of you are, if you haven't rated and reviewed the show on whatever podcast app you use, that makes a big difference. It's quick and easy. It's easy. It's free. We would really appreciate you taking a minute to do that. And finally, as always, a very special thanks to our wonderful executive producers. They are Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode for you next week. We hope you'll join us.
This podcast is part of the Democracy Group.